This is a paid commercial program and may not represent the views of Bonneville International Corporation or Federal News Radio. Statements and opinions from this broadcast are solely those of the individual contributors or advertisers as indicated. Federal News Radio does not take responsibility for those statements or opinions and accepts no responsibility or liability for any inaccuracy, errors, or omissions reported during this program.
Welcome to For Your Benefit, presented by NITP, the federal leader in retirement planning seminars. Join NITP this morning for an hour of plain talk on planning your future. You've got questions, they've got answers.
Good morning and welcome to For Your Benefit. We're here this morning to talk about mid-career, checkup, and refocus. Seemed like a good idea because last week we did beginning career focus. And it's Tammy Flanagan, Senior Benefit Director, NITP, Weekly GovExec columnist, and seminar presenter. Good morning, Tammy.
Good morning, Bob.
Okay, we're going to do it again, but the focus will again be on mid-career. My name is Bob Lines. I'm a tax finance type with NITP. And Dorothy, our ever-efficient engineer, is waiting for your calls at 202-465-3080. And Tammy reminded me, as we were getting ready in the, quote, green room, end of quote, before the show, that we should say something about Senator Robert Byrd's unfortunate passing this morning, and fine gentleman over the years.
Yeah, I talk about Senator Byrd at my seminars a lot of times because I worked at the FBI, and back in the late 80s, early 90s, they moved the FBI fingerprint division to West Virginia. And I always say, you know, the reason for that was that Senator Byrd was boosting the economy of his state, which he did a very good job of doing, and built some beautiful office space there. And a lot of federal work now gets done over in West Virginia as a result of his efforts, which, you know, didn't always meet with great, you know, nobody really always liked that in Congress, but he did a good job of taking care of his own people in his state. And I think that's why he served for 56 years.
Yeah, and they have an outstanding training facility. I believe it's through Interior there.
Yeah, Shepherdstown.
Yeah,
a lot of federal employees are familiar with the Robert Byrd buildings that are over sprinkled over the state of West Virginia. And I remember a long time ago doing the other radio show where we started out with Mike Causey, and Senator Byrd was a guest at one point, and I remember meeting him there, and I thought, you know, what a distinguished and nice gentleman he was. As important as he was just as friendly. And I had brought some strawberries from my home garden, and he said, oh, those look lovely. And he took some, and he was very nice.
Wow.
Yes,
wow.
I have pleasant memories of Senator Byrd from my experience.
Not only a benefits whiz, but a farmer.
No, not really. They just kind of grew wild on the side of the house. Didn't have to do much tending to strawberries.
All righty, let's tend to our mid-career folks. Tammy, what is mid-career? Is it any particular age?
That's a good question. You know, you walk into a seminar that we term it the mid-career planning seminar, and you'll have anywhere from a 25-year-old to a 75-year-old walk in the door. So apparently employees consider themselves at different points of the game mid-career. I guess it depends on what your goals are. And that might be an important thing for people to do, is to start thinking about terms of, you know, how long do you really want to work? Is your goal not to work a day past age 55? Or do you enjoy working and that's your fulfillment and you want to work as long as your body will let you work? You know, your goals would be different if you plan to keep working till you're 92 like Senator Byrd, or until you're 55 like my husband. You know, everybody has a different idea of what retirement means to them. And I think that's the first thing, is to define that. And if you're not sure, a mid-career point, you know, in your life might be a time to start setting those goals. And I think that's a lot of what we do in a mid-career seminar, is think about, when are you eligible to retire? How much longer beyond that eligibility do you think you want to work? How are you going to get there financially? You know, what are some of the tax things you need to think about? So mid-career, I think, is a very important time in someone's career, because it's still time where you could make a big change in your career. You might leave federal service, go to work in private industry. So we talk about, what do you take with you if you leave? What do you leave behind if you don't stay a full career? So I think it's a big time in people's career where they're facing the fact that, I'm either going to make this for the rest of my life, or I'm going to make a change and take the other Y in the road.
And with, in today's environment, I see people at the pre-retirement seminars and they go, well, I haven't been with the feds very long, only about 10 years or so. So they're even pre-mid-career, depending on how, like you say, how long they want to work. But they need to be aware that for every year they work, for every 5 years that they work, these are the opportunities that are there for them, regardless of age. Mm-hmm. I think I saw a profile or a stat on the age of the new hired federal employee, and they weren't in their 20s.
Not
I think
all,
it was
no,
early 30s.
Not. Right. So, have a mid-career. In fact, our new the FERS system, the newer retirement system of the two, was really designed to be more portable in that it would allow recruiting of employees who had already spent maybe 15 years in private industry. So they've developed some experience and knowledge. We're not necessarily bringing them in right out of high school and college anymore, like the old civil service system tended to do, where you kind of rose up through the ranks, even if you didn't have a higher education. But with the new system, we can hire more competitively and shop the private sector market and find employees who are at the top of their field in private industry and recruit them into federal service. So sometimes you are finding people brand new. I did a seminar last week where we had employees in their 50s and some in their 60s who had attended a kind of new hire seminar, more or less. You know, that most of them had less than 10 years on the job in the government. You know, they had worked already either a military career or maybe perhaps a career in private industry before they came to federal service.
Okay, so let's say we define a mid-career person not by age, but say 10 years on the federal job, maybe 15. And if that was the middle, what have they earned to that date, let's say 10 or 15 years, as far as a benefit goes?
Right, and another thing to add to that, you know, timing of mid-career, if you want to think about it another way, as far as Social Security goes, a working career is considered age 22 to 62, so that's 40 years. So you figure you take the midpoint of that, it's maybe 20 years to go, 20 years on the job. Mm-hmm. By definition, that would probably be mid-career if you really to try to put a definition to it. So what was your question again?
Can I retire? I met the outer band of that. No. Yeah. No, if somebody's been in the federal government for 10 years, maybe up to 15 years, what have they earned towards their retirement at that date? And
they're vested at that point. Okay. I mean, they're more than vested.
What does vested mean?
Vested means even if you left the day after you decided you've had enough, that you still take most of everything with you. You have three different levels of retirement benefits in federal service now. You have the basic retirement benefit, which is like your company pension. We call it the FERS basic benefit. The vesting requirement for that is 5 years. Once you have 5 years of civilian federal service, even if you don't stay until you're old enough or have enough service to retire, you still have something to show for that. So as an example, let's say you've got 15 years on and you're only 45 years old. So you leave federal service at age 45 with your 15 years of service. And when you reach your 62nd birthday, you'll be eligible to receive a benefit for the rest of your life equal to 15 years of service, which would give you 15% of your average high three salary when you left. So if your average high three, just for round numbers, let's say is $100,000, that'd be $15,000 a year starting at age 62 for life, even if you don't stay till you're 62.
And that would work for somebody that maybe wasn't inside the Beltway and their average high was $50,000, would still be half of that, right?
It would be $7,500 a year for the rest of your life, whatever it is relative to your wages. So you have that basic benefit. Then you have, you know, Social Security you've paid into most likely since your first summer job in high school all the way through the last day you work. And so whether you're paying into Social Security as a federal employee under FERS or whether you pay into Social Security while serving in the military or whether you work in private industry, that's going to follow you throughout your lifetime. So you're just building on that as you continue in federal service or whether you leave federal service, it's the same system. So that's just going to be a lifetime accumulation of earnings that's going to result in a benefit in the future. And then your TSP, vesting there is 3 years. And every dime you put in your thrift plan, every penny that the government matches what you put in, that's immediately vested from day one. The only thing that takes 3 years to vest is the automatic 1%. That the agencies obligate to your TSP account if you're under FERS. So anything you've accumulated in that TSP account after 10, 15, 20 years of federal service, you can either leave it in the thrift plan and add your future 401k money to it later on, or you can roll it out and move it into your next employer's 401k plan if that seems to be a better move, depending on your circumstances. So everything you have is still there. I think the one thing you have to realize is when you leave federal service and you go into the private sector, you'll find you'll still pay Social Security. You'll still have to set aside part of your income for savings and 401k plan, whatever the type of retirement savings they offer. But you may very likely not find a pension. So keep in mind that you're going to have to save more in the private sector if you don't have a company pension than you would have had to save in the federal service, knowing that you have that FERS basic benefit. And it's a major difference.
Okay. Let's say somebody is mid-career and close to saying, no, I'm at the end of my career, because I had a career prior to joining federal service, and let's say I'm 58 or 60, but I can't get Social Security. Is there the Social Security, or is there an add-on to my FERS benefit if I'm ineligible to collect Social Security because of age, but I'm just, you know, I've had it. I've worked all these years, maybe some for feds, maybe some for private industry. Is there something called, what do they call it?
Well, it's called the FERS supplement.
That's
it. Yeah, let me back up a little bit just so people understand what this is, because a lot of times employees aren't even aware they have a FERS retirement, let alone a FERS supplement. Under the FERS system, when it was designed back in the 80s, one of the requirements in designing a new federal employee's retirement system was to create a system that could stand side by side of civil service. And a lot of people realize that under the old civil service system, the retirement age had been 55. You know, if you came in early in life, you could plan to retire as early as age 55 if you had 30 years of service. So in the design of FERS, which occurred right about the same time the Social Security full benefit age was going from 65 to 67, the concession was made to move the federal retirement age from 55 to 57. So under FERS, we have what's called a minimum retirement age that's somewhere between 55 and 57, depending on when you were born. It's being kind of grandfathered in as we speak. And so when you reach that age, if you have 30 years of federal service, just the same as you would have under CSRS, you can retire. So the problem was, since FERS was based on Social Security coverage, well, you're too young for Social Security at 55 or even 57. So Congress included a FERS supplement as a temporary add-on to the FERS basic retirement benefit. So when you qualify to retire with 30 or more years of service at the minimum retirement age, or even if you work until you're 60, where you only have to have 20 years of service to qualify for an unreduced retirement, you'll get your FERS retirement plus this supplement. And the supplement's going to continue being part of your FERS retirement until you turn 62 or until you go back to work. So if your idea of retirement is to retire from federal service on Friday and start a new job on Monday, you're not going to receive the supplement very long, because you're going to be asked if you worked last year, every year that you receive it. And if you make too much money, you'll lose it. But it was really designed for someone who plans to retire, in that true sense of the word retirement, at a younger age. You know, they don't want to work necessarily till they're 62. Well, they don't have to, as long as that TSP worked out for them.
Okay, good. Now, I get the question in class with regards to the supplement. Does that come from Social Security or does it come from OPM? And the answer is it comes from?
OPM.
Okay.
Yeah, the Office of Personnel Management administers the FERS basic benefit, and they calculate and pay the supplement as part of that benefit. So when an employee retires and applies for their FERS retirement, if they're eligible for the supplement, it'll just be automatically included in their payment. There's no separate application for it. Now, when it ends, and when you turn 62 or later, then it's time to apply for Social Security. So you'll have to do that on your own. You contact Social Security Administration to begin receiving those benefits, which are different from the supplement.
Right. And of course, I'd have to say that the taxation of Social Security is much better than the taxation of the supplement.
Yeah.
I just have to say.
Even that. The calculation is better, because it's going to include your whole lifetime of wages, not just your FERS wages.
Yeah.
So it's a whole different benefit, but at least it's something to tide you over, kind of bridge the time. Yeah, taxes is probably something we should also talk about with mid-career planning at some point this hour.
Okay. All righty. Now, they've reached this, if you will, milestone, and they've earned what you call the vested amounts in both the TSP as well as their federal annuity. But if they work beyond that, of course, we wouldn't be talking about mid-career if they were going to retire. We'd be talking about pre-retirement. But for every year that they work after that, is there some goal that they should mentally establish?
Well, what they're working for is the goal of, I guess, at some point in time, having enough income to pay their outgoing expenses in retirement, just for waking up every day and not having to go to work. So what that magic number is for everybody is going to be different. You know, what kind of lifestyle are you going to live in retirement? What do you plan to do? What kind of house do you want to live in? So, you know, you have to set some financial goals to see where and how long it's going to take you to get there. So for some people, when they reach 57 and they've got 34 years of federal service, you know, they'll have that goal met. They'll have enough income from their FERS retirement, their TSP savings, and their Social Security supplement or the FERS supplement that they can pay all their expenses and ride off into the sunset and retire at 57. For others who maybe weren't as diligent or weren't aware of how to save and how to manage money for retirement savings early in their career, well, the nice thing there is they can plan to work a little longer, save a little more heavily in those post-mid-career years to make up for lost time. In fact, if you consider mid-career to be around age 50, at age 50 is when you qualify to make catch-up contributions in the thrift so that you can actually add more than the normal tax deferral limit to your savings account. If you look at your account balance and you say, wow, you know, this isn't going to get me to where I want to be by the time I'm 57, so I better learn to live on less now and save more so that I can reach that goal before I reach 80. Maybe I can push it back to 62, you know, maybe save enough that I can make that goal happen. So I think mid-career is really about goal setting.
Okay. And with regards to goal setting, you and I have traveled in the same circle for 20 plus years now. And I, in the back of my mind, you say, get the personnel. What is it? The person, what do you call it? The personnel folder?
The official personnel folder.
Okay.
It's a sacred document in federal employees' itinerary there. A federal employee has what follows them throughout their entire federal career, personnel folder that includes documentation of their career, their insurance coverages, many of their beneficiary forms, any personnel action, training that you've attended, things like that. But that official personnel folder is going to be the evidence of your career. So if there's something missing that shows, doesn't show when you started to work or when you had a break in service or when you went from full-time to part-time, there's going to be a little difficulty in documenting your service when it comes time to retire, because your length of service is what one of the primary factors in calculating the amount of FERS or CSRS retirement benefits you're going to receive. So I always tell employees, especially mid-career is a good time to check on this, is to make sure that you have your own personal personnel folder. In other words, have you kept your employee copies of those documents that were filed in the official folder that your agency's maintaining? Because if you don't have your own record of that service, then you're assuming that the agency is going to do a job of maintaining that folder throughout your career, which 99% of the time they do. But I have seen occasions where things get misfiled, misplaced, lost, shredded, flooded, burned, stolen, destroyed, you name it. And even with now transitioning to electronic personnel folders, I don't think that that's going to solve all the problems that could occur. So I think if you really care about getting the retirement that you've worked for and that the credit for the service that you've performed, take the responsibility to maintain a complete history of your career as well. That way, if something does turn up missing or if something's so faded that when it was scanned into the electronic format, it's not readable, you can say, here's my copy. I've kept it in a nice dry file cabinet and it's still readable. And look at that. You can see the date on it. And I don't think employees realize how important that is to have that record of service. And then on top of that, you may find that there's times where you work for the government, but you didn't pay into the retirement fund. You may have had temporary service, seasonal work, and you have to consider whether or not you have to make a contribution or a deposit to cover some of your past service. So mid-career is a good time to check with your personnel office, your retirement specialist who worked there, and find out, is there anything missing from my records? Can I get a copy of things I didn't maintain myself? Do I owe any money to the retirement fund? And if I do, what happens if I don't pay it? Those are some questions you want to talk to your benefits people at your agency before you get to the point of planning and setting a retirement date.
Okay, and none of our listeners should misconstrue any of our comments to say anything negative about an agency, let alone OPM. Picture what they're dealing with if people have changed agencies, jobs within an agency, and the volume of paperwork and the like. And like you say, some of this stuff is pretty old and could be faded.
Well, the cardboard folders, too, have passed through numerous hands. You know, they've gone from your personnel file to a supervisor, back to the personnel file, back to the records sets. You know, so they've bound things. Things are just bound to happen to records.
Yeah. And again, no slight.
Not at all.
It's amazing that they're as accurate as they are with all that.
Absolutely.
All that activity. All right, so let's say somebody could buy time, if you will. Sometimes you see that with military buyback time, or somebody worked part time and they were quote covered. How does one know whether they're covered or not?
Well, sometimes they don't realize it. You know, oftentimes you're hired into federal service. You think, well, I'm a federal employee. I'm a civil servant. You know, you just think from that point forward everything counts. But in reality, when you're first hired, in some occasions, not every occasion, but in some occasions, maybe they didn't have a permanent slot for you. So they put you under a temporary not to exceed 1 year appointment. So you didn't have retirement coverage from day one. Maybe you didn't get that coverage until you were a year into your job. depending on when it was, you may not have to pay for it, because under the old system, that service could have counted even if it wasn't contributed. But under the new system, under FERS, if it was performed before 1989, you can pay for it and credit it for retirement. If you don't pay for it, it just simply doesn't count. And if you performed any kind of temporary seasonal work, summer jobs, things like that after 1988, even though they're part of your service computation date for leave accrual, you'll get to the next leave category sooner, they won't count for retirement. You can't even pay for them. So, you know, without going into all the details of what counts, what doesn't count, and so forth, just a heads up that if you think back over your career and if you've saved the records of your service and you look at that little box on your notification of personnel action statements where it says retirement, if it says FICA, that just means you paid into Social Security. If it says CSRS, of course, that means you were covered under the old civil service system. If it says FERS plus FICA, then you did have FERS coverage, you're okay. So, you know, check it out and see if you had retirement coverage from day one. And did you have summer jobs, seasonal work, temporary appointments? It's likely that you may have had some of that deposit service or missing contributions. But this is something that your civilian personnel office, your human resource division, someplace in your agency where they handle retirement, that's who you want to go to. You know, the people that hired you aren't the same people that are going to retire you. So you need to go to a different office and find that person or that staff of people. Depending on how large your agency is, they may have a regional center. They might have one person who's responsible. They might even farm that job of retirement counseling out to a different agency if you work in a very small agency. But find out who it is that handles retirement where you work. There's somebody. There's somebody that's responsible for retiring employees off of your payroll. And those are the people that even at mid-career time, you can ask them, do I owe any money? Could you look at my personnel folder to see if there's any missing contributions? Because the longer you wait to pay that money back, the more interest that's going to accrue.
What's the cost to buy time, if you will?
It depends. If it's military service and you want to pay for 4 years of enlisted time in the Army, then you're going to make a contribution that's equivalent to 3% of what your base pay was when you served. And you don't owe any interest if you're first hired into federal service. The interest doesn't start to accrue until your second anniversary. So you can actually pay it back interest-free if you find out at orientation that you have a military service deposit. So it'd be wise to look into that and find out and do the homework to see how much you owe. Under the old civil service system, the contribution was 7% because we didn't have Social Security coverage and didn't have the thrift. But under FERS, the contribution for military service is 3%. For civilian service, it's roughly 1% that you owe for a deposit. So it's a very small contribution, but it can result in a very valuable increase to your future retirement benefit. So in terms of finding this out, this information out about your own circumstance, you're really going to have to either check with your agency specialist or with your civilian personnel office and find out if any of this applies to you. It's something you want to put on your to-do list if you're not sure. And if you're... depending on the agency, some agencies will give you a retirement estimate even 5-10 years before you're eligible to retire. So you could see the value of that retirement with and without paying back that deposit. And that really tells you the true value of whether or not it's worth paying. But under FERS, I think the rule of thumb to keep in mind is that unless that service was covered by FERS, it doesn't count. It's either you pay it back and you can count it, or you don't pay it back and it's not going to count for retirement. It can count for leave, it can count for other things, but retirement is a different definition.
Which then brings us probably over to the financial side of things. Mid-career, we're looking now at, okay, we're going to retire whenever. What do we need?
Yeah, what do we need to fill in the gaps? Because it's pretty easy to predict your Social Security benefit. It's pretty easy to predict your FERS basic benefit. Just a moment ago, if you caught what we were saying at the beginning of the hour, we said that under FERS, you're basically accruing 1% of your high 3 for every year of service. It's actually computed on years and months and sick leave counts, but roughly it's 1%, 1.1% if you're over 62, of your high 3 for each year. So 15 years of service, you get 15% of your high 3. 35 years of service, you get 35% of your high 3. And that's just a good, easy way of kind of estimating, ballparking how much your future retirement is. It doesn't take a Pentium 5 processor to calculate that number. You know, get a little pencil and paper, and I think most of us with a third grade education could figure that one out. With Social Security, the Social Security Administration sends us a report every year giving us an idea of what our Social Security benefit's going to look like at 62, at our full retirement age, and even if we work till we're 70, they continue to estimate that benefit out to those ages. The only thing you have to keep in mind under Social Security is if you decide to stop working when you're younger, you know, you want to retire at 57, then you're going to have five fewer years of wages included in that future estimate. So you may want to go onto Social Security's website and modify that estimate, which you can do online, ssa.gov, and take out those last 5 years of wages and see how that's going to affect your Social Security benefit. So you look at that, you look at your FERS retirement, you say, okay, I got Social Security coming in, you know, $1,500 a month, and FERS coming in at $2,000 or $3,000 a month. Well, that's not going to pay all my bills. You know, I still need another $2,000 a month if I was to retire today to make ends meet. So where's that going to come from? Well, that's your investment income. And that's going to be the one that's more flexible. You know, you can take out $2,000 a month the first year. Maybe next year you need $2,200. Maybe the third year you decide retirement's not for you and you go back to work and you want to stop taking money out. So that's the one you want to keep as flexible as possible. But okay, you want to accumulate as much as possible.
So the accumulation then would be in the TSP and outside of the TSP. You wrote a great article, as you do every week, in GovExec, and it talked about the TSP payday, and you had a nice grid chart in there about taking monthly payments at a certain age and the dollar amount, assuming a certain amount in the TSP. So when one looks at this, TSP's got a great calculator, right? So
yeah, very simple to use calculator, very user-friendly.
So when making this mental, as well as I think it ought to be written, okay, where's the money going to come from? But more importantly, why do I need the money? So you almost do it in reverse. What do I need? Mm-hmm. And then you go, okay, where is it coming from? Some, like you say, is pretty simple to calculate. Probably the investment side is not so simple to calculate.
Yeah, there's a calculator that is available. It's on TSP's website. I believe it's also linked from opm.gov as well. It's called the Ballpark Estimator. Mm-hmm. And you can fill in some basic information about what you do have, you know, as far as your Social Security estimate, your future FERS or CSRS retirement estimate. And then it can help you determine how much you should be saving to reach that goal. You know, put in your future retirement projection date and you enter in some pretty basic information. It doesn't take that long to fill it out. And then you can get an idea of how much you need to save to get to that goal.
Yeah.
And for some people, it can be depressing. I was going to say you need to save $5,000 a month, which is maybe impossible. Mm-hmm. But for other people, it might be a reassuring check, you know, kind of a check mark to say, hey, I'm kind of on goal or I'm only slightly off where I need to be. So mid-career is a good time to do that ballpark
estimate. It couldn't
estimate.
Be better than mid-career. Pre-retirement, it's getting a little late.
You know, unless you decide pre-retirement is mid-career after you do the checkup.
And talking about finances, of course, we do pre-retirement, mid-career, beginning career seminars, and one of the major aspects of it is financial planning. And I'm not trying to dance on anybody's misfortune, but last week it was found that somebody catered to primarily the law enforcement community and did retirement seminars, but unfortunately it was a Ponzi scheme like the Madoff, not quite to that level, and it's very unfortunate. The good news is it didn't affect a ton of people, but those that it did affect, it was a lot of money.
Yeah,
and so
the point
being is, again, I don't want to highlight somebody's misfortune, but if you're dealing with a financial planner, know their credentials. More importantly, when you get those statements, I'm an accountant primarily, and I understand the finance side. I am never insulted if somebody comes in and say, you know, my mortgage interest is deductible. And I say, yeah, I got the drift of that the last 40 years. But they're asking questions, and I urge people, small business owners, or just ask a question, just ask the question. Mm-hmm. And unfortunately, I don't think these people ask any questions, and they were getting bogus statements, and the money was being stolen from them.
Yeah, what happens sometimes at seminars, you know, you go to a seminar, whether it's pre-retirement planning or you're buying insurance, whatever it is, you're expecting the person presenting the information is the expert and you can trust them and your agency hired them to come in. So you're thinking, well, I'll just hand my life savings over to this person. Well, sometimes the agency is not familiar with who it is that they've hired, and maybe they went to the lowest bidder. And sometimes there are some financial planners who will do seminars for free only because, and there's nothing wrong with this as a way to get clients, I guess, is that they want, you know, the future outcome is to get maybe you to transfer your TSP money to their firm and they can manage it for you and sometimes do a very good job of it. But keep in mind that you know, when you're doing that, look into the company you're going to hand your career of savings over to and make sure you know what it is they're investing in and how long they've been in business and how many other clients they've had similar to you. And just don't put all your trust in someone that you really don't know other than they came and did a seminar in front of you
for 6 hours. And one of the taglines with this unfortunate situation, there were just these terrific rates of return promised on government-backed investments. But don't ask for the money for the next 7, 8, or 9 years because it's locked away. Well, if it's too good to be true, and then just challenge the person. Most people are not financially literate, and there's nothing wrong with that. It's just something that runs against a lot of people's grain. So a good financial planner should be able to answer it, say, yeah, the money's over here. Here's where it is. Here's proof of it. It's, you know, it's not in my bank account.
Yeah.
And
well, one thing we've always prided ourselves in the seminars that we do, and I know you say this every time we get up to talk, is that we don't sell anything other than information. You know, we provide an understanding of your benefits. We provide a way to set goals financially. If you want to hire somebody who works for us, fine. But, you know, that's not why we're here. We're here to give a seminar.
We don't farm emails,
we pay our
website.
Speakers, you know,
that's right.
You know, we pay the speakers to come in and give information, and they're not to sell a thing. And that's one reason why I've always been so happy to be associated with this company for 22 years, because I feel like it's a stand-up company. You know, every speaker we use, I feel honored to know.
Yeah.
So I always feel bad when you hear a story like that because it gives all of us a bad name. And agencies maybe pause and say, oh, maybe we shouldn't hire these people because, you know, what if they do the same thing? But you do have to do some research. And I don't know much about this company other than now that we're getting some bad news about what had happened.
Yeah, I've read the article and then read the lawsuit by the SEC. And you know, it's just had all the earmarks of, you can't promise people this.
No.
And be on the up and up. But anyway, it happened, and very sorry for the folks that did get caught up in it.
Yeah, on that same note, and this is not necessarily going to be something that's a fraud or anything like that, it's just something to be cautious of, is that a lot of times, especially mid-career, you may go to a seminar where someone is selling life insurance in exchange for the government survivor benefit. Because, you know, the best time to buy life insurance is when you're young and healthy. So around 45 and 50 would be a good time to start telling employees about the value of, you know, an insurance policy versus having the government survivor annuity, which is going to cause about a 10% reduction in your FERS or your civil service retirement. So the lure of buying life insurance, which has maybe some cash value to it, maybe a lower premium, would be attractive to somebody. But there's a lot of things about life insurance that are different than the nature of a survivor annuity. You know, a survivor annuity is going to pay, and we're typically speaking about a spousal benefit here, would pay a surviving spouse whether they outlive you by 6 months or whether they outlive you by 36 years. It's a lifetime benefit, and it's adjusted every year for inflation. And going over history, you know, the rate of inflation has averaged about 3% a year. You can't promise an inflation adjustment with a term life insurance policy. It's just not the way it's sold. So be wary of that as well. The reduction to your retirement to provide a survivor benefit, if your spouse dies first, you stop paying for it. It's meant for a surviving spouse. It's protection for that spouse's lifestyle and income so that they're not left destitute if you predecease them. If you bought a 20-year term life insurance policy, at the end of 20 years, you got to renew it. And if you're 75 years old, it can be very expensive.
Forget it. And if you didn't, like you say, do your homework in advance. And picture this. This is just very simple. If somebody wanted to replace a survivor's annuity with life insurance, and you'd have to project it out with inflation, figuring the person with an average life expectancy, et cetera. But if you did it kind of simply like this, if you had $1 million policy and unfortunately the person passed, that $1 million should generate $30,000 to $40,000 a year income to the person and have a normal life expectancy. Now, $1 million policy, most people say, you're crazy. Well, do it with $500,000. Then you have to be taking out more to get that $30,000 or $40,000, and you could exhaust the $500,000 in the pot.
And the other thing of that, too, is just the emotional aspect of just picture your spouse, you know, whoever they are. You know how they handle money. You know how they are emotionally. If your spouse was to wake up one day and you're not here and they get handed a check for $500,000, what are they going to do with it? How are they going to know how to invest it? What if your children have just declared bankruptcy and they just lost their house? Would your spouse be inclined to hand them $100,000 of the $500,000, thinking, well, I got $400,000 left, you know, that should last me. And then speed the clock up 20 years down the road and their $400,000 is now down to $20,000 and they're only 82. How are they going to last the rest of their life? So I just think there's a lot more risk involved with buying life insurance when you're comparing it to the security of the annuity. It's expensive. They're both expensive if you buy enough to do an adequate job. And be careful of who's selling it to you. If the insurance salesman is saying, my life insurance is going to do the same thing as the survivor benefit, remember that there is an incentive for him or her to sell you the life insurance than there would be to, you know, use the government survivor annuity. Just go into it with some common sense and some good questions. Like you said, don't be afraid to ask stupid questions because they're not stupid.
And just ask them anyway.
Yep.
And it shows the person that you're thinking.
Yeah, insurance might be appropriate where your spouse is not totally financially dependent on you. I'm not saying never buy. Life insurance has a good place in our financial planning. But I always worry when someone says, oh, yeah, I'm not going to do any survivor benefit. My spouse never worked outside the home. I'm just going to buy a 20-year level term policy. And I just cover my ears and say, oh, my goodness, you know, be careful. Yeah. Make sure your spouse knows what they're getting into, what they're signing off on.
All right. Let's revisit some of the closet financial planner Tammy's comments with regards to future income. In other words, if you know what you need today to pay today's bills, it's not what you're going to need tomorrow to pay tomorrow's bill. Now, the FERS annuity, as good as it is, it has a, quote, diet cola, doesn't it?
And a quote. It has a limited cola. It's a cap of 3%. So if inflation goes skyrocketing in 10 years to double digits, too bad. You're only going to get a 3% cola on that life annuity through the thrift.
But even if it, say, went to 4 or 5%, it doesn't sound like much, but it's
over
huge
time,
over a period of time.
That 1 or 2% difference can end up being a 30% difference of where you would have been with a full cola.
Yeah.
Yes,
so
be careful.
Always have more than enough. And you mentioned this, somebody receives, unfortunately, life insurance, or they have some money in the bank and they say to themselves, well, my children or my friends, you know, if I don't have children, they're going to wind up with it anyway. I'll just give it to them early. Mm-hmm. You know, they'll ask me, not for permission, of course, but they'll ask me what I think. And I said, give it to them and there's a day certain that they should get it. And they go, when's that? I said, when you die. Because how do you know what you're going to need between now and then? And if you give it with the best of intention to the best of people, they may have bought a house with it. They may have bought something else. Maybe they bought an annuity or something. And there's no cash to give you back. Mm-hmm. And then they'll go, well, they have to pay taxes. Well, it's always better to pay taxes on a larger amount than a smaller amount. Always. So I'm going to get in a lot of trouble with that with some of the younger folks listening. But you know, let's be fair.
Right. Yeah, you don't want to give your money away too soon. One of the questions that comes up, and sometimes at a mid-career planning seminar is when this comes up, because people are starting to think about, you know, oh, I got 15 years to go and I'm starting to really visualize myself retired. And they start thinking about, you know, where am I going to live? And this question always comes up, and I know you answer it when you come in the next day. So I just say Bob will be here tomorrow. But I think the listeners might be interested to know about the states. You know, there's all kinds of taxes. That's probably why you've been in business so long.
Yes, thank goodness. People grimace when they hear taxes, but you know, for me, it's job continuation. But
yes.
I get the question in class, and I have a page, actually 2.5 pages in my section, and it's from National Association of Active and Retired Federal Employees. Every year they publish all the states in the country that have a special tax glimmer to them.
Yeah, it's NARFE.org if they're looking for
NARFE.org.
NARFE.org.
Okay. Fine organization, but sometimes there's way too much emphasis placed on taxes. You know, I'm going to move for tax reasons. Don't move for tax reasons. Move for others. But then they go, okay, now I want to hear the best state in the country to retire. And I said,
yeah.
It's easy.
Or what's the tax-friendly state? That's the other question.
The best one is Alaska. I know. Why is it good? No sales tax, no income tax, and they pay you to live there.
That's right.
But as I always say this in class, I said, but I don't see a mass migration of retirees to Alaska. Then I go, what's the second and third? And I said, well, that's hard because they're not all created equal. You know, Florida doesn't have an income tax, but it does have a sales tax and it does have high real estate taxes. I'm not picking on Florida. Texas is attractive, no state income tax. I mean, there are a number of states that just don't have an income tax. Alaska, Florida, Nevada, New Hampshire. It's got an income tax, but it's just on dividends and interest. South Dakota Tennessee, dividends and interest. Texas, none. Washington State, none. Wyoming, none. So,
is there a balance between, I've always wondered this, like if, so Florida was a good example, the first one. So if they have no state income tax, but they still have to have schools and roads and they have to have all the services people need. So you said, well, they got a higher real estate tax, they got a higher sales tax. So a state has revenue coming from real estate, from income tax, from all the different, some even have local municipality taxes. So somehow they got to get money to do business, to do, make things nice and be a nice place for someone to live.
Mm-hmm.
So it's always going to be a balance, isn't it?
Or is there some balance, states
that have just a low overall everything, like Delaware or places like that?
Well, Florida, though, is having some trouble. So besides the real estate taxes and the sales tax, they had taxes from people that went for vacation,
mm-hmm.
conventions, and the like.
Well, tourism.
They might not be doing as much of that in today's environment, especially on one side of the state. I'm not saying you shouldn't go there, because that one side of the state, the Gulf side, it is an all impacted by this awful oil situation. But nonetheless, people go, no, I'm not going to go there. And then some people that move down there find that it's too hot and it's not really what they thought it was to be. And let's not pick on Florida. It could be anywhere.
Yeah.
You lose your place of reference and you move to any other state other than the one you live in. You might have some regrets and then come back.
Right.
But taxes should be in the top five, but they should never be the primary focus. I think quality of life, I hate to sound so drippy with that, but quality of life, which would include health care, certainly ought to be up there in the top one or two. And then a social network. I don't know that I want to move out in the boonies if I don't know anybody.
Unless you're a loner.
Yeah, I'm a loner, and I've been accused of that, but I still don't think I can live with myself for more than 2 days. So I have to be around somebody else.
Yeah, my husband, a friend of his, moved to Texas and bought a, I don't know, it's like 200-acre ranch, basically, in the middle of nowhere. And they're as happy as can be, but that's not for me. So you have to figure out, you know, what it is that would make you happy.
So, and there are magazines. Now, NARF has this great summary, but it's taxes. Kiplinger's newsletter publishes something, not every year, but every other year or so, and they'll say, okay, these are the best states to retire in. But it's all things considered.
Retirement Living Magazine also does a profile every month in their magazine on what, you know, different locations throughout the country, which are kind of hot retirement locations.
Mm-hmm.
And they'll outline taxes along with education, health, all the things you listed there as far as what does that location have to offer.
Yeah.
And what are its drawbacks? What are its benefits? So do some research, like you said, besides taxes, because some people zoom in on that taxes. Oh, this one doesn't tax federal retirement benefits. I'm going there. But look at the overall quality of life.
New York, Massachusetts, and Pennsylvania. None of those three tax pensions. Now, is somebody going to move to New York, Massachusetts, or Pennsylvania for tax reasons? I hope not.
No.
Because while they might not tax pensions, they tax everything else that moves. Now, again, I hope I'm not making anybody mad, but it's just there for somebody's edification.
Just so that you can put it in perspective.
Yeah.
Right.
So
same with D.C., Maryland, and Virginia. If you retire in this area, you're going to pay income tax on your retirement, but yet, you know, this might be where all your friends are that you've worked with for 30 years, or this is where the good hospitals are, and I can get to 7 shopping malls within 20 minutes.
So, yeah, the intangibles are shopping malls, but of course, and if you want to listen to rock and roll, you can listen to rock and roll. You want to listen to classical music, you
anything
can listen
you
to,
want.
You know, their concerts.
Any given weekend, there's 15 different things going on downtown. So if you like to have things to do, and you're going to have plenty of time to do it if you're retired, you know, some people like to stay put and retire where they spent their career. Now, it seems like the trend is more and more retirees are not leaving this area. You know, we have such a big concentration of federal employees in the D.C. area that I think a lot of them do end up staying here.
And they might downsize, too. I see these communities more popular than ever.
With waiting lists.
Yeah.
Greenspring Village and Riderwood Village, you got to get on a list and wait for someone to, I guess, die. I don't know what happens, how they get the vacancies.
Well, some of the newer ones, a builder is building out in not way far
Leisure
out in Virginia.
Leisure World.
Leisure World is one. Another one, Pulte, is building, one-level places.
Of the over 55 communities.
Yeah.
They're becoming very popular. And with this baby boomers getting into that category, they're going to have to build a whole lot more.
Okay, so some of the people are saying, what's this got to do with mid-career? It's got everything to do with mid-career.
Everything.
You've got time now, and you can talked to people that have gone here, there, or otherwise. You can listen. We do our show, and we bring in second career types, but we also do the psychological side of retirement. We spend a fair amount of time on where you're going to live, who's going to be the
life
support system,
etc.
And but now, mid-career, you got time to make your most informed decision. We're 1 year out, so it's not too late, but you got to do a lot of studying.
Well, this whole idea of having mid-career training came from our early seminars back 20 years ago when we'd do a pre-retirement seminar, which were generally restricted to people who either had their application already in or they were within a year of being eligible to retire. And the people would end up at the end of our class saying, wow, this was great. We love this, but boy, I wish we would have had this 20 years ago when we could have actually done something differently or made some changes in the decisions that we made. And so I think mid-career time is a good time to do a checkup. You know, just look at your beneficiary forms. Have you kept them up to date? Look at your health insurance. Are you going to be able to carry that health insurance into retirement? Look at your retirement. Are you going to be able to reach that goal in 15 years of being able to retire? Or aren't you saving enough, or aren't you managing it well enough? So I do think that goal setting in mid-career time is an ideal time to really sit back and say, where am I?
Well, let's take that just a little step, unfortunately, further. Mid-career couldn't be a better time to look at things, not that we're planning upon one's passing, but, you know, where's whatever I have going to go? Beneficiary forms, like you say, for the thrift and or life insurance. Do I have a survivor's annuity option? Do they know it? I mean, how does anyone know that mid-career?
Well, we talk about that at the mid-career, and I kind of tread into it gently because I know nobody likes to think about what if, you know, what if I don't make it to retirement? But when I'm finished with that discussion and we talk about life insurance and the retirement benefits payable to your family if you shouldn't be here, I see this kind of this look of relief on people's faces saying, wow, I didn't know, you know, I was that well protected. I didn't know my family was that well protected. Because under, we're talking mainly here to FERS because the majority of federal employees are now under FERS. Over 80% of the workforce is FERS. But the same would hold true for CSRS. If an employee dies in service, if they're survived by a surviving spouse, dependent children, or in some cases a former spouse who has it written into their divorce decree, there are survivor benefits payable to those family members. Your surviving spouse, if you have 10 years of service or more, would be entitled to receive 50% of your FERS retirement for the rest of their life if they should outlive you. Even if you never made, there's no election you make as an employee, that's just there. If you have less than 10 years of service, the surviving spouse gets a lump sum. They call it the basic employee death benefit. And that means that the surviving spouse or the former spouse with it written in the court order gets a lump sum payment equal to half of your salary rate, half of your annual pay rate, plus another payment included that's currently about $30,000. And that's not life insurance. That's just a retirement benefit if an employee should die in service with 18 months or more service. Like I said, if they have more than 10 years of service, then there's the annuity. Under CSRS, there's no basic employee death benefit, but there's also no 10-year service requirement, and the surviving spouse gets 55% of the retirement you would have had had you retired the day you died. So for an employee who dies in service, there are benefits payable that you're not maybe not even aware of. As far as life insurance goes, a lot of employees around mid-career time start to reevaluate their FEGLI, their Federal Employees Group Life Insurance. Because if you're carrying option B of FEGLI, that's the option that allows you to elect multiples of your salary where early in your career you may have elected five multiples. Maybe you were starting a family, you bought a house, you got married, so I better insure myself to the gills. And now that you're mid-career level, you're saying, wow, I didn't realize I had that spousal benefit built into FERS. Maybe I can drop a multiple or two of FEGLI because I have enough coverage through these other benefits that are starting to develop. So that's the time you want to look at your FEGLI coverage and maybe even look at possibly replacing FEGLI with a private term policy. There's nothing magic about FEGLI other than the fact that it insures everybody in the government, regardless of their health, and it also floats with your salary as your pay goes up. But if your needs for life insurance are starting to go down, you don't necessarily need it to continue to go up as you get older, unless you're going to start a family mid-career. And so you may want to shop around and see what else is out there. Now, if your federal career is going to take you to dangerous parts of the world, you're going to be spending time in Afghanistan or Iraq, you probably don't want to replace FEGLI because it pays no matter what. Some life insurance policies have a clause that says we don't pay of an act of war or terrorism, so be careful about that. But certainly look around, because you might find that you can save some money on life insurance by replacing it, the government plan, with a private plan. There's nothing wrong with doing due diligence and looking and making sure you've got what's best for the money that you're spending, possibly freeing up some money that you can buy long-term care insurance. Might be enough of a difference that it would fund the cost of that type of policy.
Right, and when looking at life insurance, one wants to get the best rating one can, and they have different ratings, super-duper preferred, and then normal, which normal means you might have high blood pressure. You maybe had some issues in the past. So before going in, eat right for about 6 months. Don't drive race cars. cut out the ice cream.
That's underwriting. A lot of us aren't familiar with underwriting if you work for the government, because there was none with Fegley. But with private life insurance, you may have to submit to a physical, and that's going to maybe limit the type of insurance or the amount of insurance you can purchase, and it might even raise the price. But if you're good health insurable, it's likely you could find cheaper rates on the outside market.
Okay, Dorothy's given us the two fingers. That means 2 minutes, by the way.
the peace sign.
the peace sign. And so you've done 90% of the talking, as usual, which is great, because I learn. I hope everyone listening learns as well. But final comments?
Just do start setting goals. Start really becoming informed and learning about your benefits. Don't rely on somebody else to do it for you. Hire professionals when you need to, but understand what they're telling you. Ask questions.
And that would be my key, too. You've got this great benefit, but the FERS folks really need the financial side well squared away. Ask those questions. It's hard to learn enough to be totally conversant with maybe a financial planner or an accountant. Probably you should talk to a financial planner more so than an accountant. But just ask a question to ask a question.
Yep. And next week, didn't you say we might dig up an old financial planning seminar to put on for the July 4th holiday?
I'm torn between a financial planning one or the thrift savings
one, which we're both financially related, so you might get a follow-up if you listen next week.
Yeah, but if it is the TSP, it's going to be the two main people at the TSP, Greg and Tom, and it was just a great show.
It was, yeah. And it's you get financial planning out of that, so I think that it all fits the bill.
That might be what we should do.
I think
But by the way, for those of you listening, don't call next Monday because Tammy and I won't be here, but you can email us at nitpinc.com. And with that, we hope you have a happy 4th or an enjoyable 4th, I guess, right?
Yep. Enjoy yourself. Yeah, it's a nice holiday. No stress.
And I forget who's coming on
the week after. I don't know either. That's too far.
Okay. Bye-bye.
You've been listening to For Your Benefit, presented by NITP. Please tune in next Monday at 10 a.m. for a topic solely devoted to you, the federal employee. The show can also be heard 24/7 on federalnewsradio.com. Thanks for listening.
WFED Washington, WWFD Frederick, WWWT FM HD2 Manassas, the Washington, D.C. home of Navy athletics. The Federal Drive has a new sound. Tom Temin is joined by Amy Morris weekday mornings from 6 to 10. Tom and Amy cover the activities important to federal managers, HR, program management, budgeting, acquisition. The Federal Drive delivers fast-moving, crisp, insightful interviews good for busy feds dealing with political change. The Federal Drive with Tom Temin and Amy Morris on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM.